of Birdsong. This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from Kim Middleton at the Alaska Raptor Rehabilitation Center. I'm Don Glass.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose CAS annual lecture series presents Mechanical Brains and Responsible Choices by Michael Moore on Tuesday, September 29th at 7:30 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum. Online at www.cas.uiuc.edu.
In sports this afternoon, in college football for the weekend, Illinois has the week off. Unbeaten Northwestern plays at Syracuse tomorrow night, and on the college football schedule around the state, Southern Illinois hosts Southwest Baptist. Eastern Illinois is at Southeast Missouri. Western Illinois takes on Stephen F. Austin, and Illinois State faces Austin Peay. Eagles quarterback Donovan McNabb is doubtful for Sunday's game against New Orleans because of a cracked rib. McNabb sat out of practice for the third straight day today. Kevin Kolb took snaps with the first team on the Eagles and is expected to start if McNabb can't play. Coach Andy Reid says McNabb has been feeling better every day. Kolb would be making his first career NFL start. The St. Louis Cardinals' magic number to clinch the National League Central is now 8, heading into their weekend series with the Cubs at Busch Stadium, John Smoltz against Ted Lilly. The Chicago White Sox open a homestand at U.S. Cellular Field tonight with the first of three games against Kansas City. They trailed Detroit by 6.5 games in the American League Central. Roger Federer rolled to a 6-3, 6-4, 6-1 win over Simone Bolelli to give Switzerland a 2-0 lead Friday over Italy in the Davis Cup playoffs. He was playing 4 days after his five-set loss to Juan Martín Del Potro in the U.S. Open final. Federer shook off two breakpoints in the opening game and was never in trouble. And former President Bill Clinton described Melvin Simon as one of the most remarkable people he's ever met as he gave a eulogy at the funeral for the shopping mall developer and Indiana Pacers co-owner who died earlier this week at the age of 82. The funeral took place in Indianapolis today. And that's a look at sports on WILL, a part of Illinois Public Media, the listener-supported broadcast service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 2:43 on the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Tom Rogers. One of the country's biggest hotel chains recently fired all of the cleaners in its Boston-area hotels. Hyatt Hotels cited challenging economic conditions, but the workers are not going quietly. Hundreds of them and their supporters demonstrated in front of Boston's downtown Hyatt Regency after reading about their layoffs and replacements in the Boston Globe. Philip Martin has the details.
Over the summer, housekeepers at Hyatt Regency hotels in the greater Boston area were told to train a group of temporary employees. But on August 31st, the temps were hired permanently, and those who trained them were sent packing. One of them was Lucine Williams.
I was making $15.32 an hour.
Williams had cleaned rooms for Hyatt since age 19, but 21 years and 11 months later, she and about 100 other Hyatt housekeepers were escorted out the door by hotel security. For this immigrant from Barbados, it was the only job she'd ever known, and with it came badly needed health benefits.
I got a 13-year-old son. He has asthma. I don't know what's going to happen when the insurance finish. All I keep thinking is, what did we do that was so bad that they couldn't even give us an option? They couldn't even give us a chance.
Hospitality Staffing Solutions of Georgia, the contractor hired by Hyatt to replace Williams and other housekeepers, pays $8 an hour and does not provide benefits. The two companies have worked together for several years, but never on this scale. Hyatt issued a statement saying that the decision was prompted by the unprecedented economic environment and the need to adjust cost in response to continuing declines in revenue. Even so, some hospitality experts and union officials here thought the move highly unusual.
Never in the history of the Boston hotels have we ever seen the complete outsourcing, contracting out of an entire housekeeping department. Never.
Janice Locks, president of Unite Here Local Union 26, representing area hotel workers, says more protests are planned to urge the rehiring of the fired housekeepers. She believes that getting those jobs back can only happen if the controversy impacts Hyatt's bottom line. The company reported an 18% drop in revenue in the first half of this year, but several guests walking into the Boston hotel said Hyatt should not make up for loss on the backs of his lowest paid employees. And outsourcing housekeepers, they said, could affect their decision to stay here again. For NPR News, I'm Philip Martin in Boston.
Right now, America's breadbasket relies on an aquifer that's nearly drained, and many say it will dry up if farmers keep pumping water from it at the current rate. For the Environment Report, Devin Brown tells us the government plans to pay farmers as one way to get them to cut their water use.
Bob Price is every bit the Heartland farmer. He's dressed head to toe in denim. He's got aviators, cowboy boots, a belt buckle the size of a small plate. Just like his neighbors, he grows thirsty plants like corn and alfalfa on land that is so dry and so sandy, many agricultural experts think it's not suitable for farming. But when Price moved to southwestern Kansas in 1973, this didn't seem to matter. In his pickup on the way to his farm, he tells me that it was the beginning of an irrigation boom.
Out here, everybody was getting up early and going to work, and all of West Highway 50 was irrigation pumps, irrigation pipe, irrigation engines, well drilling outfits. You know, this was like a frontier then.
At that time, the government heavily subsidized the cost of irrigation. The farmers were getting an immediate return. Their land appreciated almost overnight once irrigation was established. So farmers began to pump water, and lots of it, from one of the world's largest underground water supplies, the Ogallala Aquifer. They pumped 2 feet of water for every acre they farmed right onto their crops.
Meanwhile, the water table is declining, and the water that we're pumping is coming from farther and farther down. And even with the same energy cost, it costs more to suck water up out of the ground from 500 feet.
At the same time Price's irrigation bills were skyrocketing, rivers were drying up, and several states in the plains were suing or being sued for taking more water than they're allowed. Several states initiated water conservation programs as a response. Kansas was the first to do so without the threat of a lawsuit. The program started in 2007. The strategy, pay farmers to permanently retire their water rights. Price had actually been wanting to take some of his land out of crops anyway. He's a prairie chicken enthusiast, and he wants to start a guided hunting business. And prairie chickens need prairie grass.
Oh, we're farming one day, and we're thinking, gee, sure would be nice if we could get this back in grass, but it's an overwhelmingly expensive proposition.
It's not expensive to plant or grow prairie grass. You don't need any irrigation for either. But you do need irrigation for a cover crop that the farmers are required to grow for 2 years before they can get to the grass. Susan Stover is with the Kansas Water Office.
If we did not get something reestablished there, we could have potentially, like dust storms again, you know, those sand dunes moving and some real serious blowouts.
Blowouts like Depression era, Dust Bowl blowouts. So Price has to plant a cover crop and pay double what he gets from the conservation program just to irrigate it. Ironically, the government pays him sizable subsidies to keep other land and corn, which needs water from the aquifer to grow. So basically, one government program is paying Price to eventually stop using so much water, while at the same time, other government programs are paying him subsidies to grow the crops that need so much water. Price would actually like more money to put the land back into grass. But if he wants to lead hunting trips for prairie chickens and he wants prairie grass, there's only one outfit willing to pay him anything to plant that grass. The government. For the Environment Report, I'm Devin Brown.
And now, something completely different. The French designer Gabrielle Coco Chanel invented the little black dress. She freed French women from their corsets and created a label and a perfume that remained chic almost 40 years after her death. A new film tells the little-known story of the young Chanel, the orphan and cabaret singer who became the toast of the fashion world. NPR's special correspondent Susan Stamberg has more.
As an old woman describing her beginnings, Coco Chanel said, "I was able to start a high fashion shop because two gentlemen were outbidding each other over my hot little body." In the film Coco Before Chanel, those two men, who will help make her an icon, talk about her as if she were property. But because of them, the penniless, canny Mademoiselle Coco, played by Audrey Tautou, becomes the famous, fabulous Chanel. The film begins in 1884. Coco is dumped at a dreary convent. Her mother is dead, her father disappears. Depressed, a wild child. In the convent orphanage, the girl will learn a skill that shapes her future.
She's going to learn how to sew.
Anne Fontaine wrote and directed Coco before Chanel.
But at the beginning of her life, she sewed, but for her it's a boring activity.
All young girls sewed in those days. Coco wanted to be special, and she was, even then, in certain ways. Throughout the film, you see Totu as Coco looking at things, and she examines them in a very special way.
Animal way. You know, it's physical. It's very, it's through the hands and through the eyes. She catches everything like that, you know.
At the convent, bored and miserable, Coco examined closely what the nuns wore.
Black and white. And every day she looks at this black and white. It became the fetish colors of Chanel style, you know.
The colors she liked the best.
The best.
And yes. Really the signature of her style.
Yes, and the black, it was very revolutionary to put a dress in black, because black it was for the men or for the people who lost somebody, les veuves.
Widows.
Widows.
At 18, Coco gets a day job sewing for a tailor. At night, in the small town, she sings in cafes. She didn't have much of a voice, did she?
No, she's a bad singer. She sings in a very lower-class cabaret.
But in that seedy cabaret, Coco meets and then moves in with her first gentleman. What was she to him? Was she his mistress, his lover, a courtesan, a whore?
If you don't want to say a too much violent word, you say courtesan. And if you want to be more aggressive, you say whore.
She was aggressive, ambitious, and poor. Her options were limited. That first man, a polo-playing playboy, introduces her to gentleman number two, Arthur Boy Capel, another polo player, tall, dark, handsome, the love of her life. Boy takes her to the sea at Deauville.
Regardez avec leur meringue sur la tête.
And she looks at all these women on the beach. She says that she's like in a pastry shop.
In a pastry shop.
Pastry shop, because they are with these hats, and it seems that she have cakes on her head, you know. Very long skirts, corsets. You can't be free.
Coco begins getting rid of all the clutter. She grabs her boyfriend's sweaters or trousers or jackets and cuts them down to her own slim and flat-chested proportions. She dresses simply in spare colors.
And after that, the other women looks at her and say, oh, he's so beautiful, chic.
They want to look like that, like a new woman, free. They ask Coco to make their clothes, and they begin to buy her clean-cut, simple hats and jackets and dresses. Those wealthy women help Coco become Chanel, just as her gentleman friends do. So here she gets these two wealthy men, and loads of others after them. What was her secret, Anne Fontaine? Was it sex? Enormous charm? Was she so smart? She sure wasn't a beauty.
Of course she was smart, but the charisma she has, it was a very free personality. She was not afraid of nothing. It's not beauty. It's something stronger than beauty.
Gabrielle Coco Chanel was a survivor, and it showed. She survived abandonment, abject poverty, the loss in a car crash of her true love.
All her life, it's a success, of course, a successful story, but also with tragedy always underneath. And that makes the life, the personality, and her talent very interesting, because it's not only a success story.
The film Coco Before Chanel ends with the 30-something designer on the brink of fame and fortune. By the time she died at the age of 87 in 1971, Coco Chanel was a legend who made clothes you could easily wear tomorrow if you could afford them. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
When it comes to hurricanes, apparently size does matter, and new research suggests the bigger the storm, the more tornadoes it spawns. For the Environment Report, Tanya Ott has more.
Last year, Hurricane Ike ripped through Texas and the Midwest. It was a relatively weak Category 2 storm, but it spun off a lot of tornadoes and caused $32 billion in damage. Researchers at the Georgia Institute of Technology say they've got a new model for predicting how many tornadoes a hurricane will cause. Dr. Judith Curry says storm size, not intensity, is the key.
A lot of times people just think, oh, it's a Category 5 or it's a Category 2, and they immediately calculate the risk to damage in their head, and the 5 is bad and the 2 isn't so bad.
But Curry says sometimes a 5 can be small and tight, and a 2 can be big and produce a lot of tornadoes. The study is published in this month's Geophysical Research Letters. Some scientists blame global warming for larger and more intense hurricanes. For the Environment Report, I'm Tanya Ott.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Joyce Foundation and the USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
About 200 public radio stations now provide some of the most comprehensive news coverage available, and of course, AM 580 is one of them. Help us continue to serve your community. Show your financial support before the next pledge drive begins October 14th, and tell us you'd like to help build a member match fund to challenge more listeners to support WILL Radio. You can give online at willpledge.org.
Earth and Sky.
It's causing massive amounts of very disturbing mortality, upwards of 95 to 100% at some hibernation sites.
That's biologist Malia Bayless, and she's talking about bats and a fungus that's affecting them. It's called white nose syndrome. Bayless is with Bat Conservation International in Austin, Texas. She said white nose syndrome has killed thousands of bats in the northeastern U.S. over the past several years.
If you talk to people in New York, they don't see bats in their streetlights anymore.
And now, Bayless said, the fungus is expected to spread to the American South.
We don't really have any good idea of how to stop it or slow the spread. You can't really apply a broad-scale fungicide to a cave ecosystem because you'll completely destroy all the processes that occur in the cave.
Bayless said bats might face extinction because of this fungus. Meanwhile, she said, funds for studying the fungus and stopping it are limited.
We really can't move forward with the limited resources that the state and federal agencies have.
Understanding and controlling white nose syndrome in bats, said Bayless, is important because bats eat insects over crop fields.
Anytime you take a top predator out of the ecosystem and a top predator that is a primary consumer of insect pests, we're probably going to feel those effects in agriculture.
For interviews with scientists, visit our website. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.